When I first started looking at sort of psilocybin data, I thought it was BS, honestly. The first few studies I read, I thought this is just too good to be true.
Well, Doug, hey, thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation. I've been so looking forward to it. For the folks who are listening, Doug is the CEO of an innovative company called Cybin. Cybin is developing really exciting research that is psychedelic or psychedelic adjacent for neuroscience indications. Doug also has a storied history in building and scaling companies across pharma, having built, I think, 4 companies at this point, completing 16 acquisitions in total and raising over $1 billion in capital. So Doug, thank you so much for taking the time to have the conversation.
Hey, Brandon, thanks for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Tell us a little bit about your background, your history, the kind of career you've had thus far.
You can probably tell from my accent, I grew up in the UK and spent the first part of my career there. I actually started working in a lab, a biochemistry lab for the National Health Service. Interesting working for the government in that you can see your salary, what it's going to be for the next 30 years, all laid out despite your capabilities. And that wasn't very attractive. So I moved into pharma, spent the first half of my career, I think it's now 35 years, the first half building drug development companies, but through business development, R&D licensing, product licensing, M&A. As you said, I've been involved in a lot of acquisitions. At one point, for a company I was head of M&A at, we completed 15 acquisitions over a 4-year period, which is kind of insane. That's closing an acquisition every quarter for 4 years across Europe, Asia, and the US. So I spent a lot of time on a plane, as you can imagine. And then the second half, I've run 4 different companies now as CEO. The first was a generics company I co-founded in 2008. And we took that from inception to about $500 million in revenues and in 35 countries in about 5 years. So that was a great first start as a CEO. I then took over for a turnaround a spec pharma company, it's a NASDAQ listed company, as chairman CEO. Then I ran a CDMO, contract development manufacturing organization, and then Cybin, which is obviously more biotech. So I've been very fortunate to have really quite broad exposure, kind of across the spectrum, many facets of drug development. That really helps with anticipation. Driving a company forward is like driving a car. You know where you're going to go. Sort of getting from A to B is sort of the simple part of the equation, but the hard part is anticipating what's going to hit you along the way. And so I think that's that experience helps a lot with that anticipation.
What drives you? I could imagine you built your first company. You're an executive for a long time. Then you built your first company to $500 million in revenue. Where did the kind of passion, the energy, the drive to go to Act 2, Act 3, and then now Act 4. Like, where did that all come from?
I just love building things, frankly. I always have done. And I love being at the cutting edge of things. I started back in college. I was studying biology and then ended up specializing in molecular biology, genetics. Because it was leading edge, and every week or month it seemed like there was a new paper that was taking the field forward. It was much more interesting than other parts of biology I could have been studying. And so each time I moved to something different. So the generics company that we did very well at and scaling, by the time we got to like 4, 5, or 5.5 years in, and we had scaled to 35 countries, the sort of exciting growth part of it was done for me, right? So it was time to move to something else. And the next thing I moved to was very broken. It really was in a company in a mess that had made a few acquisitions, overpaid for one of them, and then found itself in trouble. And so that required a lot of cleaning up. So it was a completely different mission than the first one. But I just love building things and being in areas that are novel and interesting. I mean, psychedelics is definitely that, in that so there's so much that's still unknown. There's some stigma, controversy around these treatments. So an interesting and exciting area to be in.
Talk to us about that. So we're now in Act 4, your fourth company here. Why now? What convinced you to kind of jump into this side of the world?
Well, I think a couple of things. The first is that I spent a lot of time being involved in drug development, and what you learn is that it is slow, and it is generally incremental. And so each drug we develop is maybe a little bit better than the one before it. it's rare that we see massive leaps forward. We do, of course, from time to time, but for the most part, you're seeing a slightly better drug, you know, coming along than the one before. But what we see with psychedelics is a once-in-a-career opportunity to make a massive impact, because these treatments just have huge effect sizes. It's interesting, when I first started looking at the psilocybin data, I thought it was BS, honestly. The first few studies I read, I thought this is just too good to be true. I've been involved in CNS drugs for quite a while, and there is nothing in history that has an effect size like we've seen in some of these early academic studies out of Johns Hopkins and NYU. And the more I looked at them, and the more that we saw more studies being published, it was clear that this was real. There was really something there. You know, to be a part of that was exciting. And also, as I said, you know, as you get older, you get to choose what you want to do. And I was kind of also, aside from being able to help a lot of patients, I was also a little bit attracted by the controversial nature of it all. And having been in pharma a long time, which is quite conservative, it's a refreshing change.
Now, obviously, you know, the early papers are coming out, the effect sizes are astounding, but still there's regulatory risk, there's stigma, like you've said. How did you triangulate these things to kind of get enough confidence to go all in here?
Yeah, it's interesting. So when I first leapt into the space, there really wasn't anyone else from pharma in the space. There were a lot of psychedelics companies that were starting around that time, and Compass had started maybe a year or two before. But even the Compass leadership at that time were not from pharma, more of a mission, you know, by some a pair of clinicians. And so I think a lot of the mindset was exactly as you say, how do we make this work? How do we get through these challenges? I saw it very differently, actually. I saw these molecules like any other drug development program, like any other molecule. I mean, I think there's a lot of questions at the beginning of this field as to like how these treatments would come to market. Would they be legalized? Would they be natural mushrooms? Would they be synthetic? Are they going to be like retail stores like there is with cannabis? And I think it became very clear to me quite early that the fastest and safest and most likely route to an approval was going to be down the FDA pathway, because it gives cover to every other agency. I mean, there's no reason for DEA to suddenly reschedule these molecules while there are drug trials going on. There's a wait, you know, for the data. There's no reason for politicians, policymakers to suddenly make these scheduled compounds broadly legal while there are drug trials going on. So why not just let the FDA do their job and companies do their jobs and prove that these treatments are safe and effective? So I think it's been fairly clear from the beginning what the pathway is. And we've been really quite fortunate, actually. FDA has been very proactive. They've handed out 4 or 5 breakthrough therapy designations in this sector, which is remarkable. They've issued draft clinical trial guidelines for psychedelics fairly early on in the growth of this sector. So I've seen FDA being quite proactive and I'd say quite supportive, despite some of the news and some of the media coverage around the Michael situation. That's not really reality. The reality is I think FDA is being really quite interested in the potential for these compounds and what they can do for patients.
Now, I want to get into that in your programs in a minute here, but before we get there, I'd love to know how you thought about which psychedelics to pursue for which indications in what order. Is there like a framework in your mind? As I dig in and I learn more, I'm seeing MDMA for PTSD, psilocybin for depression, you have a DMT program for GAD, LSD for GAD, there's esketamine for depression. How have you thought about where to kind of place your bets here?
When you're leaping into developing something new, you've got to rely on some existing data. So there's been a fair number of studies performed on psychedelics, but primarily they're around psilocybin and LSD, if you look back through the last several decades. Psilocybin is about half the duration of LSD, so much more practical and scalable. You know, LSD also has a certain stigma around it that we thought was maybe one step too far. Psilocybin hard enough to overcome some of the stigma. And also the safety profile of psilocybin is a little better than LSD. So we started there. But as we got more into this and looking at, you know, how do we want to expand the portfolio, when you look at the whole space, there's really two categories of of psychedelics being developed right now. You've got these orally bioavailable, mystical experience, longer acting psychedelics like psilocybin and LSD. And then you've got the non-orally bioavailable, fast-acting, highly immersive molecules like DMT and 5-MeO-DMT. So our goal was to create the best in class in each of those categories. We've done that with a psilocin compound and with a DMT compound, each of which we've generated. So we started out with psilocin in depression because that's where the most data was. And we also believe that MDD, major depression, not TRD, treatment-resistant depression, is a very large population with a massive unmet need. Why did we choose GAD for DMT? Well, first of all, it's likely that both compounds will work in both indications. But each of these compounds creates some level of anxiety in patients. The beauty of DMT, is that in particular our generated version, is that effects begin very quickly. With regular psilocybin, you might be waiting an hour for effects to kick in. With our deuterated psilocin, we see effects in about 15 minutes. With our deuterated DMT, we see effects in about 2 to 3 minutes. So it works really quickly. And then people are in this very intense DMT experience that there's no thinking about anxiety when they're already in that space. And then it lasts about 90 minutes. So very scalable. So we think that deuterated DMT is more suited for anxiety disorders than say psilocybin, but I think they would both work for both indications.
Why are they both likely to work for both indications? How should we be thinking about cross-indication kind of applicability?
I think that's the most exciting thing about these compounds, actually, is that we've seen evidence of them working in many, many different indications. So, and that's rare, and it's fantastic for investment, to be able to take one compound and get multiple different indications out of it. So we've seen evidence now outside of MDD and anxiety, we've seen evidence in PTSD, postpartum depression, opioid use disorder, alcohol use disorder. You know, these might even work, and there's still work to be done, but it may even work in schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. I mean, collectively, that's hundreds of millions of people in the U.S. alone that we could help. So that's really interesting.
I want to dig into the science a little bit here. So you mentioned your unique formulations, these deuterized versions of these compounds. What does that mean? How should patients think about that versus maybe the traditional forms of these compounds?
Yeah, so there's a couple of changes that we've made. With psilocybin, psilocybin is not an active agent. It's metabolized to psilocin in the body, and psilocin is what's creating the psychedelic effects. So we've removed that metabolic step, and we've deuterated psilocin, the active agent. And then with DMT, we've applied deuteration to that as well. What that is it means that we've taken selected hydrogen atoms on each of these molecules and we've replaced them with heavy hydrogen or deuterium, hence deuteration. What that does is it changes the pharmacokinetics without changing the pharmacology. So what does that mean? It means it changes the way that the compounds get into the body and to the site of action in the brain, but it doesn't change how they work. Right? We don't want to mess with the receptor binding profiles because that leads to either changes in efficacy or changes in safety. So we wanted to keep the pharmacology intact, but make them more efficient at getting to the site of action.
For the folks at home who are hearing all this exciting news and maybe seeing other people pursuing research that look similar on the surface, how should people be thinking about your programs versus other programs? What are the key kind of markers that people should be looking at to really understand?
I think the main difference with what Cybin is working on compared to other companies in the space is that we've taken the time to modify these molecules. You know, other compounds that are being developed are well-known, what I call generic versions. So psilocybin, LSD, 5-MeO-DMT, DMT have all been around for decades. We didn't simply take those pre-existing molecules, we created new ones. And we created new ones in order to make them more druggable, if you like, more suitable as therapeutics. And at the same time, creating IP protection for the company as well and for its shareholders.
Pharmaceutically optimized, one might say.
Exactly.
So I've been seeing a lot of really exciting news about your phase 2 study for CYB003, upcoming phase 3. Tell me a little bit more. What do you have on the horizon? How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, so our deuterated psilocin read out a phase 2 study in depression at the end of last year. And really it's hard to put into words just how incredible data was. What we saw, 75% of patients having remission from their depression, so no longer met the clinical criteria for depression, 75% of them after just two doses of CYB003. Not two doses a day or 2 weeks of dosing, but just two doses. And then we still saw 75% of patients in remission 4 months later after just two doses. So that's remarkable. It's a real game changer. So it means that we have the potential to move away from the current standard of care, which is SSRIs, which don't work for the majority of people. They're taken every day. They take 6 or 8 weeks to work. So people are waiting that long while they're depressed for the drug to actually have some effect. And then they come with these chronic daily side effects, some of them pretty awful. Weight gain, insomnia, some cognitive effects, sexual dysfunction. There's a lot of evidence now that SSRIs cause sexual dysfunction in men and women. And sometimes this can persist for life after patients stop taking the drug. So there's a lot that we're learning about SSRIs now that they've been around for 40 years. Suicidality. I mean, depressed patients have a 20 times higher risk of suicidality, but SSRIs actually increase suicidality by at least twofold, and in some studies much more than that. So there's a really big need for these treatments, and now we've got an opportunity, I think, to, instead of just daily dosing, to intervene, and we see rapid and very large effects on depression symptoms that seem to be highly sustainable. Later this year, we'll have 12-month data from that phase 2 study. We'll be able to see how many patients are still in remission, you know, 12 months later. So based on that, those results, we're about to begin a phase 3 study. We've met with the FDA a couple of times around the program design. Great alignment with them. The first study will start around the end of the summer. And we've already recruited 30 sites across the US and about 7 other European countries as well. So looking forward to kicking that off.
What is top of mind for you as you go from phase 2 to phase 3? Anything at all that you're thinking about changing now that you're kind of at this critical inflection point?
Definitely front of mind is scaling, quite honestly. So it's a very different organization that you need for phase 1, phase 2, than you need for phase 3 and then kind of pre-commercialization. So we have about 55 members on our team today. Our peers that are at the same kind of stage have about 200 on their team. So we are significantly leaner and are actively expanding. I mentioned 30 sites to set up for the first phase 3 study, another 40 sites for the second phase 3 study, and several hundred facilitators that we need to train for those studies as well. So we have a lot of work to do. And thankfully, you know, because of the results, because of the mission, because many people in pharma know someone that is depressed or anxious or has a mental health condition, we have been very fortunate to be able to attract really high quality folks from big pharma, senior people with strong CNS and phase 3 experience. And that's I think that's going to help us move this forward in a very robust and rigorous way. And I think that's really important as you think about moving from phase 1, phase 2, where you're looking for proof of concept, to phase 3, where you're looking to optimize your results, because that's the data you'll be marketing with in the future. So we go from speed focus as the primary focus to quality, obviously being the primary focus as we get into phase 3.
Talking about optimizing results, given the really dramatic effects that you've already measured, how much more optimization of the results are you looking for here?
You know, we've thought about that long and hard. So there's a few things that we have designed into the studies to optimize outcomes. The first is the molecule itself, right? So we've, as I mentioned, we've optimized the PK through deuteration, but we've also done quite a bit of work on dose ranging to find a dose that we think is going to get more people across the line into this psychedelic space without running into, you know, unwanted side effects. So the molecule and the strength. The second is we are studying an MDD population, so major depressive disorder, not treatment resistant depression. TRD, that group is going to contain folks that are highly refractory to all treatments, including likely psychedelics. So selecting an MDD population, which is, you know, 80% of the depressed population, is going to provide, I think, you know, obviously better outcomes than in the TRD population. We're also dosing CYB003 as an adjunctive treatment. So that's one very convenient It means the patients don't have to immediately come off of their background medications. But it's just practical as well. I mean, you think that patients are on stable doses of SSRIs and you're asking them to come off of those. Yeah, scary and challenging. Scary for the patient, challenging for the physician as well. So they can get started right away. And then the last thing we've done is created a two-dose protocol. The reason we did that is we saw in some of the early academic studies, there's really impressive results from two doses. What we see with psilocin, is that it is a bit of a wavy experience. There's peaks and troughs of intensity throughout the session. And some patients who are anxious or skeptical or just not willing to kind of fully immerse themselves and let themselves go, don't want to necessarily trust the process, they can resist to some extent the experience. But what we found is that by the time they have a second dose, they're diving right in. And in the phase two study, the facilitators reported to us that the second experience for everyone was more intense. They've gotten past that initial anxiety or apprehension and diving right in. And in other studies with psilocybin single doses, we've seen effects begin to wear off after 6 or 8 weeks or so. And yet with two doses, we're seeing robust effects out to 4 months so far. So there's a number of things there, you know, the molecule, the strength, the indication, in a dosing protocol that we think are going to optimize the data.
What do we have to look forward to in terms of this this 12-month readout? Can you say?
First thing I say is that if you have just even one patient that was still in remission 12 months after just two doses, you'd be pretty impressed with that. I think just because it does still just in my mind just doesn't seem possible. It doesn't happen really, does it? Very, very often, whatever disease state you're talking about. So, what we're looking for is, trying to understand what portion of patients remain in remission. It's a fairly small study and a fairly small number of patients, but we'll get some kind of signal from that. And I think that's going to be really exciting. I don't think any other company has read out 12-month data yet. But to be able to show that level of durability is important for, obviously, for patients, but also important for payers as they're thinking about this new model, moving away from your chronic dosing to this intermittent dosing. And then, of course, in phase three, we'll also follow patients up for a year. So we'll have a really good sense on a much larger scale of what the typical kind of relapse time is. I'd be surprised if you weren't seeing at least maybe on average 8 or 9 months or something like that. Some people may go for much longer. Others may be a little shorter, but on average, it might be in that sort of 8 or 9 month range, which would be remarkable.
Yeah. Do we know anything yet about developing treatment resistance to psychedelics?
We don't. We know a little about it, I should say, in that we know that these work on a threshold effect. So these are serotonin receptor agonists, and they're activating these receptors on the surface of nerve cells. And when they become flooded with these drugs, then you get to a threshold point where then the receptors internalize. And that's the point we're trying to reach with dosing. You know, we don't want a little bit of activity like you might get with microdosing. We want a full-on psychedelic experience and internalizing these receptors. Of course, once those receptors are internalized, they're no longer available to be agonized. So if you were giving repeat doses very quite close together, you get to a point where there really wasn't any effect. And you see that with folks recreationally that have tried magic mushrooms or even MDMA, that there's no incremental benefit of rapid repeat doses. So in our study, we're dosing twice, but it's 3 weeks apart. So there's plenty of time for the receptors to all reset. And if we're thinking about redosing every 8 or 9 months, it's not likely because of that infrequency that we're going to see tolerance building up, not from what we're seeing so far anyway.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, which is that the FDA has been really collaborative designating these as breakthroughs. I'd love to hear from you what it's been like to spearhead a breakthrough therapy in a net new, let's call it like therapeutic asset class around psychedelics and psychedelic adjacent therapies.
So it has pros and cons, doesn't it, being at the tip of the spear? Obviously, it means that sometimes we are walking into the unknown and we're having to make intelligent judgment calls. There have certainly been situations where FDA has looked at us for expertise where it's lacking at the agency. This is a new area. And what we're trying to figure out with the agency in some cases is, how do we design studies to solve for these unknowns that we're learning? It's not just Cybin. There are other companies out there as well. So we're learning collectively from everyone else's activity too, including when things go wrong. And we mentioned Lykos, obviously unfortunate for patients, the Lykos outcome. But, that's a learning opportunity for us and an important one to have that feedback and that information ahead of initiating phase three. So I think for the most part, the bulk of the drug development here, because it's not all clinical studies. There's all the other things you have to do here, like toxicology, drug interactions, clinical pharmacology, all the background studies that nobody ever talks about, but there's probably 20 of those that we're having to do. Those things are all standard drug development. And then the challenging part is working with, on the clinical side, with the obvious unblinding nature of these treatments. And I think that's where Lykos, in terms of including in other areas, but that's one area where I think they were tripped up by their study design. And so we spent a lot of time thinking about that. And the way we are dealing with this functional unblinding is working with the FDA on study design. So functional unblinding is when a patient is taking the psychedelic agent, they're having an experience, and because they're having an experience, they know they're taking the active drug. They're in a clinical study, right? So they're in there to get better, so they have an expectation that the drug will work, right? So the unblinding leads to expectancy. What the agency has asked us to do is to run a three-arm study. So three groups of patients. One group will receive a high therapeutic dose. The second group will receive a mid dose, a sub-therapeutic dose. And then the third group is going to receive placebo for a safety control. What it means is, with these psychedelic naive patients that are receiving active, either the high or the mid dose, is they won't know which one that they've received. But both groups will feel something. And so they'll both have expectancy, right? And so if you see separation of the high therapeutic dose from placebo, and you don't see separation of the mid therapeutic dose from placebo, then you know it's the drug that's working, because there's expectancy in both groups. So it's quite simple to do. It's not a surprise or anything new to FDA. Every single CNS drug has functional unblinding. If you're in a clinical trial and you're taking a benzodiazepine, you're taking a benzo. If you're taking an antipsychotic, Even SSRIs, patients know, they can guess. So unblinding isn't new, and how to deal with it isn't particularly new.
How do you think about setting this mid-dose? Like, how do you know that you're not going to accidentally provide a therapeutic dose?
Well, first of all, we've done a lot of PK/PD modeling. And so the goal is to select a dose that is going to generate some sensations or effects so the patient can feel something. You definitely don't want it to be so low that they're feeling nothing. But assuming that, because this is a threshold effect and you need to flood the receptors, that for most people, they won't get there. You may well have some people where the mid dose is therapeutic, for sure. We're all quite variable, right? But the chances are, statistically across the whole group, that it won't be therapeutic. Now, let's say it is therapeutic statistically. Great. We've got another dose, right? The work. So there's no real downside for doing it.
It's interesting to hear you say this challenge of functional unblinding is not new. And yet, ostensibly, it's caused a challenge in the Lykos program. Where do you think that came from?
First of all, a lot of the noise around functional unblinding came from the ADCOM, the advisory committee meeting. The ADCOM members are not FDA, right? So their points of view and the huge amount of time they spent talking about functional unblinding does not necessarily represent the FDA's viewpoint. So we have to separate the two things. I think it's important for people to understand that the ADCOM's decision or perspective is not the FDA. That said, FDA has clearly been asking for a dose-ranging study like this we've talked about to deal with functional unblinding, and Lykos didn't perform one. I know they've given reasons as to why they didn't perform one, but my suspicion is, I don't know, I haven't seen the CRL, but my suspicion is that's probably what they're going to have to do in the phase three study they have to repeat.
I want to switch gears a little bit here. We've been talking about CYB3. I want to talk about CYB4 now. Tell me a little bit more about that.
CYB4 is deuterated DMT. DMT is an interesting compound. We've run five studies now around DMT and deuterated DMT in order to understand the pharmacokinetics, the pharmacodynamics. And it's an interesting molecule. It's not orally bioavailable. So you have to give it through some other route. You can inhale it, which is quite variable. You can provide it through an intravenous infusion. You can inject it, you know, intramuscularly, maybe subcutaneously. And so we've done a lot of work to try and understand the best route of administration and the best way to dose this. So over those five studies, we've now identified a dose that we're going to get, that we're giving in our phase two. We also did a lot of work at the different routes of administration. And while inhalation is great and rapid, we found it was highly variable and comes with all the complexity of having to study pulmonary toxicology and developing a device and all this other stuff. So we stepped away from that. We looked at intravenous, and we found that when you infuse this over time intravenously, it takes a long time for patients to get up into the DMT space, and some don't even get there. And that's a long time of a period of anxiety, basically, that you're creating for the patient. So what we found is the ideal situation is to get patients up into the DMT space rapidly. And you want that peak to also be short and then develop a tail period, which is the therapeutic window. That's where the psychological work is being done. So what we've ended up with CYB4 is an intramuscular injection. So really simple to give. We've all had plenty of shots in our arm in the last several years. So just a simple shot in the arm, and we see effects in 2 to 3 minutes. And then about 90 minutes, or a little less than 90 minutes, patients are in that therapeutic window in the tail of the DMT experience. So we think we found the ideal PK. We'll see as we get through the study. We're in a phase two study in patients with generalized anxiety disorder now, 36 patients. So quite small and efficient, but enough for proof of concept. We already have plenty of safety data from the phase ones. And we should expect data, top line efficacy safety data, right around year end, maybe early January of next year.
Wow. How have you thought about prioritizing CYB3 versus CYB4 as a startup biotech? Naturally, you've got constrained resources. How do you think about that?
Yeah, so obviously we're ahead with CYB3. We started with our psilocin asset. Again, as I mentioned, based on the data that was out there, it was lower risk to go with psilocybin as a startup rather than DMT, which was less understood. So we're naturally ahead with that. Right now we have phase two proof of concept data of CYB3. We do not yet have it with CYB4. So again, CYB3 is the priority. You know, once we have proof of concept for both, and we think about additional indications going forward, you know, my view is that for many people, a shorter 90-minute experience, certainly for clinics, is going to be potentially more attractive than a 4 to 6 hour experience with psilocin. So I think naturally the market might trend towards shorter acting treatments over the long term. So we'll look at adding, you know, new indications on that basis. On the flip side of that, you know, DMT is quite an intense and immersive experience, and maybe not for everyone. And others might prefer the more kind of gentle, mystical experience of psilocybin. So I think there's room for both. As I said, our goal was to create options for physicians and for patients, and to create best-in-class, and both of that longer-acting and shorter-acting treatments.
Sure. It strikes me that you're developing kind of this capability, I don't know if you want to call it a platform, for taking psychedelics, applying it to CNS indications. How do you think about that, like the kind of broader vision of the science and the kind of capability you're developing here?
You know, it's an interesting discussion that we have internally quite a lot. We've generated a lot of IP over the last several years. So we have, I think, 60 or 70 granted patents and 200 or plus that are still pending. So a lot of IP. But that IP covers a tremendous number of molecules, maybe 10 to 15 trillion molecules or something crazy like that. And there are a number that we've advanced to become clinical candidates. We've done particularly a good amount of work around phenethylamines, which is the same category of drug that MDMA falls into. But we've been looking for treatments that are less amphetamine-like, like MDMA is, and more tryptamine-like, psilocin and LSD. And the question is, okay, well, what do we do with these? What indications can we pursue? And it's kind of, we're spoiled by riches, really, in that looking at these other early-stage molecules, looking at those as in terms of investment opportunities. But we have these two advanced compounds where we know they're safe, we know the doses, we know the risk of administration, we've done all this work, several years of work. And of course, adding another indication there just makes a lot more sense than maybe starting from scratch with other molecules. So certainly for psychiatry, I think we've got two great assets that have plenty of indications to go after. It might be that some of these other compounds could be suitable for CNS disorders, neurological disorders, maybe neuropathic pain or MS, maybe Parkinson's, maybe Alzheimer's. But those are long paths to market. They're high risk, large populations that's needed in the studies, and a very different budget needed for those. So we're continuing to work on those in the background. And who knows, maybe at some point we'll generate enough data, something interesting that could be partnered with, a company that's more focused on CNS rather than psychiatry as we are.
Any hints as to what's next?
We are looking at other indications for our current clinical assets. So I'm sure we'll make an announcement when we're certain what we're going to do next.
We'll hold our breath. So I want to talk about this most recent $150 million raise. In the current kind of biotech environment, feels like doom and gloom everywhere, but $150 million is nothing to sneeze at. What was that like?
Well, it's been a tough 3 or 4 years in biotech. I mean, this is the longest biotech bear market in history, I think. Certainly the longest bear market in my career. Good news is that in general, when biotech bounces back, it bounces back hard. But yeah, it's been a tough few years raising capital. And of course, the only option you really have as an early stage company is to raise equity. There aren't many other options available. Maybe later as you get phase three data, there might be debt or partnerships or royalty streams or other things. But early on, equity is really kind of the only option. And so we've had to continue raising capital despite that sort of tough pricing environment. So it's been hard on the employees, and it's been hard on the founders. It's been hard on shareholders, frankly. But we're making great progress. This $150 million raise back in March, I think, was just massive validation. Not only the quantum, but the quality of the investors that came in. The round was led by DeepTrack. So DeepTrack and all the other investors in that round are long, fundamental, highly intelligent biotech funds that really do their diligence, really do their work. And, it's clear from that group coming in that they believe in the programs. I think there's strong confidence in the science. I think there's strong confidence in the science across the board, really. I think there is increasing confidence in the commercial model. It's taken a bit of time to get that confidence, and it's really come about because of the success of esketamine, Spravato. And they've managed to help encourage the creation of a network of 4,500 centers now across the U.S., those are all centers where psychedelics could be dosed as well. So I think investors can see that there's a platform, an infrastructure, for these compounds. But, I will say that the science isn't enough. It's important, and we're very fortunate to have compounds with really large effect sizes. So the likelihood of success here, I think, is unusually high. But it's not enough. And I think Lycos is an example of that. Success is not just based on the science. You need execution. We started out 3-4 years ago here with maybe 50, 60 companies in this sector, and we're down to a handful. And I think, the companies that will succeed are going to be the ones that are best managed, the ones that have the best teams. And of course, I think Cybin has the best team in the sector. So
maybe last kind of horizon for us to talk about here, competitive landscape post-approval. Let's fast forward 2 years from now. Like you mentioned, we've gone from 60 companies down to a handful, but knock on wood, 2 years from now, a few of them will be in market. How do you think about competing post-marketing, given similarity, probably promising effect sizes across the board?
For the most part, we've seen each of these companies select a different molecule, and each of them select a different indication. So while there are a handful of companies working on these treatments, they're all kind of adjacent, at least in the beginning here. And you've got treatment-resistant depression, major depressive disorder, PTSD, being worked on, for example. But as we've talked about, these molecules ultimately will probably get used for multiple indications. So over time, there will be direct competition in different indications. And we're not too concerned about that because we spend time at the outset trying to optimize the molecules. which, for example, LSD has breakthrough therapy designation for GAD, generalized anxiety disorder. That's terrific for us. One, I think it shows proof of concept that psychedelics work in anxiety disorders. Two, it shows that generalized anxiety disorder can be granted breakthrough therapy designation. And so that's awesome. We've got a 90-minute treatment versus LSD, which is about 12 hours. So from the outset, we know we're competitive there. And then we talked about how we're creating data in phase three to optimize the data set, all with that in mind. That will, at the end of the day, I've been in pharmaceutical sales, and you have a few minutes with the doctor, and you're able to show him one or two charts. That's about it, right? What you want is some really great charts from your studies to say, hey, look, doctor, this one has 25% remission, this one has 75%. Yeah, which one do you want to choose? So it's important to get that right from the outset. And that's why we didn't just rush in to the generic molecules at the beginning.
Let's bring it right back to where we started, M&A. 2 years from now, 5 years from now, what do you think the M&A landscape looks like? Are these compounds being acquired by some of the behemoths, or are they merging and creating a super psychedelic, super like psychiatric entity? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, at this stage, it's hard to see merging between pre-revenue companies, because it just adds to the burn, right? Because you're adding more programs. But as we go forward and there's more phase three data being generated, I have no doubt there'll be transactions with Big Pharma. There's been no innovation in psychiatry for the last 40 years. Prozac was the last big innovation. And of course, we had a number of other SSRIs after that. But this is the biggest breakthrough in psychiatry in 40 years. And so many companies have moved away from psychiatry and focused on CNS because psychiatry is difficult. Also, you know, we fall into this trap sometimes. Big Pharma falls into this trap in that we develop drugs that are effective. And then maybe there are half a dozen versions, different brands, and they all do really quite well. Each of the SSRIs was multi-billion dollar drugs. Then they go off patent. And then, of course, you've got a problem where you've got drugs that are perceived to be effective and safe and simple, but they're cheap. And so how the next drug you develop has to be much, much better because you're competing with generics. Same thing happened in hypertension. ACE inhibitors came along and suddenly, you know, there were half a dozen of those. Then when they went generic, how do you compete against generic hypertensives with something much, much better? So the innovation stops. But this is different. You know, I think first time in 40 years, we're actually changing the course of disease now, and not just treating the signs and symptoms every day. And for me, that is an opportunity that Big Pharma can't miss out on. So I'm confident they're watching, they're waiting, they're doing their homework, they're watching the trials, they're watching the IP landscape. We'll see something happen at some point.
My kind of traditional closing question for you, Doug, is there anything I haven't asked about that I should have?
You know, I think you've covered it for the most part. I think there have been a lot of unknowns in the sector over the last few years, but the field is becoming clearer all the time. You have more companies entering phase three, more data, more robust studies happening. And so I think some of those unknowns are becoming clearer. This last one with the situation with Lykos and the functional unblinding, you know, I think that's another big myth, really, that's now, I think, expelled by FDA. So I think we're in a really exciting phase. You know, you've got not just Cybin, but other companies with good proof of concept data, heading into phase three, good safety profiles. We're going to see these treatments be approved in the not too distant future. And that's quite exciting for me.
Well, Doug, thank you so much for spending the time with me today. I really appreciate it. I feel like I've learned a lot, and we've covered a lot of really interesting topics. So again, really appreciate you taking this time.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Brian, for having me on.